about you, about all the things that aren't possible, about how political calculations come first, about how you should settle for little bits and pieces instead of real change. They are telling you they will not fight for you.
Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, not so subtly, slamming former Vice President Joe Biden at the California Democratic Convention. Warren was among more than a dozen 2020 presidential candidates who spoke there over the weekend. Biden, the frontrunner in the race, notably absent. California's progressive lean was on full display, with candidates getting cheers for their talk about Medicare for All and the Green New Deal. But there were also a few candidates who were booed, including former Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper.
Socialism is not the answer. I was reelected in a purple state in 2014, one of the worst years for Democrats in a quarter century.
Hickenlooper is known for his centrist views, and during his time as governor of Colorado, he made a reputation as someone who regularly reached across the aisle. Hickenlooper is in L.A. today. I spoke with him earlier. All right, let's talk about this weekend. This conference was held in one of America's most progressive cities. So why was it important to you in that venue to distance your views from the more socialist-leaning factions of the Democratic Party? You got those boos, especially when saying that, talking about socialism and tagging someone with that moniker has essentially become a Republican talking point.
Well, I think that's the very reason why it's important for me to speak out. And we've been saying this for several weeks, that Republicans are going to try and paint us into a corner as socialists. And we have to make a clear distinction that we are not socialists. I mean, the word just has so much baggage in this country.
Mm-hmm. So, but socialism does have a different meaning for younger people that doesn't have the baggage that you associate. And in fact, Bernie Sanders did quite well for himself by describing himself as a democratic socialist. So what's the problem with it?
Well, it's a generational issue, obviously. So many younger people didn't experience the Cold War firsthand and see some of the real damages that can come to a society under socialist governments. And I think there's a sense...
That's like more communism than socialism. When we think of socialism now, we think of it more like in the Scandinavian model or even in the Western European model.
That's not the only version of socialism that has existed, though. And I think that there's that notion that you're going to have government own the means of production, which is at the heart of socialism, I think still doesn't fit into what America is. And I look at...
Well, who's calling for government owning the means of production?
Well, let's look at some of these things. So we're going to guarantee... Part of the Green New Deal was what I would call distractions, right? That we're going to guarantee every American a government job. If you look at Medicare for All, the notion of Medicare for All is based on the premise that 160 million Americans and 60 to 80% of them enjoy their private health care insurance, but 160 million Americans would have to give up that private health care. Government would essentially take it away from them. I'm not sure that that's going to work, and I don't think that's what most Americans or most Democrats are going to support.
So what is your plan for healthcare and for lowering health costs?
Well, I think that we need to move towards a public option, clearly, and it could be some hybrid maybe of Medicare and Medicare Advantage. And if it's done properly, people will, at their own choice, migrate from either from a private healthcare insurer that they're unhappy with, or maybe some people who can't afford to get health care or have some other challenge, they'll migrate towards this public option. And as it grows larger and expands, hopefully the quality will improve, the cost will come down. Essentially, we could end up in 10 or 20 years, end up in a single-payer system, but it would be an evolution, not a revolution. And I think mm-hmm. that's the key here, is that I'm not sure that you can bring government in with such a heavy hand.
Well, you talk about the heavy hand of government, but when it comes down to controlling costs, that's essentially what it comes down to, is government regulating prices. Because the free market, at least as it's practiced now, is certainly not doing that. America has the most expensive healthcare system in the world, in the Western world at least.
it's interesting. That's actually inappropriate regulation. In other words, we've created a regulatory framework where the drug companies are guaranteed certain price levels in this country, which, you know, decades ago was intended to support their research to achieve these new miracle drugs. And what we have to do is re-regulate it appropriately so that, you know, Americans, it might take a few years to evolve into this, but Americans shouldn't be paying for the medical research for the rest of the world.
All right. You have identified yourself as a pragmatist, correct?
And yes, a pragmatic progressive.
A pragmatic progressive. Okay. How is that not a moderate?
Well, you know, the labels. I mean,
we're talking about labels. You began by talking about socialism, but they are important.
Yeah, of course. They're important, but they're limited, and they also often put us in boxes where we don't easily fit. You know, I've been able to bring people together again and again. We've reduced teenage abortion in Colorado by 64% and teenage pregnancy by 54% by bringing together a whole host of private healthcare providers and nonprofits and state-sponsored clinics to make sure we provide long-acting reversible contraception, so Norplants and IUDs, and allow, make sure that we were expanding a woman's ability to or access to reproductive health care. Those kinds of things are collaborative approaches and pragmatic, but they weren't, you know, government taking over the whole system. It was government was convening and bringing people together. And my argument is that's what we've got to do for the country, right? That I'm the person who's actually done what everyone else is talking about, getting people to the table and then doing the big progressive things people said couldn't be done.
Right, which is easy to say in Colorado, where you have a history of working together. But when you go to Washington, there's quite a different environment in terms of fractiousness and inability to get legislation through. Right? And some have said, as we heard from Elizabeth Warren, that now is not the time for incremental steps. Now is the time for bold action. Do you feel like where you've staked your political position is in keeping with the tenor of the times?
Yes, I think that what we've done is create big, bold steps, but we've actually done them instead of just talking about them. And I think that's the differential there.
But do you think you're being bold enough now?
Yeah, I think our plan that we're laying out for climate change, our plan to expand access and coverage, to get to universal health care. And I think our approaches, it's true, they're based on things we've done. Washington is dysfunctional. I ran for mayor in 2003, and I'd never run for student council. And the whole point was to push back against what I called the fundamental nonsense of government. But the bottom line is that when I did that in Denver was divided, and the suburbs wouldn't talk to the city. You know, a year and a half after I got elected, we got 21 Republican mayors to work with 13 Democratic mayors to create Fast Tracks, the largest transit initiative in modern American history, 122 miles of new track, and Republicans and Democrats in the entire metro area unanimously supported a tax increase. It's human nature. You can find common ground. Again, there are exceptions. Maybe Mitch McConnell, maybe he can't be reasoned with. But in most cases,
well,
we can find common ground.
He is the Senate Majority Leader, so you have to go through him to get anything done.
Well, you have to certainly you have to visit him just because so many people look at him as their leader, and you would be writing them off. And many of them are gettable in some sort of a collaborative solution to a lot of these problems.
Would you want to get rid of the filibuster?
No, I don't. I mean, those structural changes to our system of government that have been there for, I mean, literally, in the case of the filibuster, more than a century, we should be very careful before we make those changes. But you have to do what you've got to do sometimes. And I think Mitch McConnell, I mean, when he came out and said after President Obama was elected that he was going to do everything he could to make sure that President Obama failed. I mean, that's moving towards treason in a way, right? That you're going to hurt. You're saying you want to do everything you can, even if it hurts our country, to make sure that you get a political victory.
Well, why do you think that if you were president, you wouldn't face the same opposition?
Well, you might start out that way, but
I mean, Obama was also promising to reach across the aisle and positioned himself in the middle.
And again, I have nothing but the highest admiration for President Obama. And I guess my point is that just because you couldn't succeed with the chemistry in one group of people doesn't mean you quit trying. And I don't think we're going to address climate change successfully if we can't bring a larger part of our country together around the solution. I don't think we're going to get to really controlling healthcare costs if we can't, you know, bring together the different, at the present, divided constituencies.
Why do you think that you could do this better than someone who is also positioning himself as a moderate, and that is Joe Biden, who is polling far ahead of anyone else, including yourself?
That's for sure. Well, you're not going to hear me say anything negative about Vice President Biden. He's given his life to public service.
But you are competing against him in this.
Of course,
in essence,
and we have very different life histories. I spent almost 20 years as an entrepreneur. I created over 20 businesses, over 1,000 jobs. I honestly think that's what, you know, my record of having brought people together and actually gotten things done is different than so many people that have spent the last several decades in Washington.
Speaking about healthcare, your state legalized recreational marijuana around 7 years ago, went into effect about 5 years ago, correct?
Yep, absolutely.
You did not support its legalization. You called it reckless, and you said the matter needed to be studied. Well, it's been studied. It's been 5 years since it's been in effect. Do you think it was a good idea to legalize marijuana for recreational use? And if so, would you advocate for it to be legalized nationwide?
Well, certainly the things that I most feared have not come to pass. We have not seen a spike in teenage consumption. We have not seen a spike in people driving while high. And we do a survey of over 20,000 people every 2 years. So that's good data. I do think that the federal government shouldn't tell other states exactly what they should do in terms of marijuana. In other words, that they should legalize it. We shouldn't go to Alabama or Maine and say you have to legalize marijuana. But just like we did with alcohol, I think the federal government should leave it to states to make that decision. And first, the federal government should decriminalize marijuana so that those states that where they have legalized it, they're not in conflict with federal law. I think the federal government should delist marijuana as a Schedule I narcotic so we can do research on it. And let's get the FDA to actually do medical research so we can see what forms of seizures, what forms of autism does marijuana or cannabinoids have maximum benefit? Are there side effects? I mean, just like we do with any pharmaceutical. And let's make sure we get the Department of Agriculture to look at what pesticides work and which ones might have harmful side effects. Some of the basic things that the federal government usually does aren't being done around marijuana. And I think that would be my goal, is to get the federal government should make sure the banking is legal for the marijuana industries in those states where it's been legalized.
You are one of 23 candidates. It's hard to distinguish. Oftentimes, all the candidates running, it might be hard for the voters, too. I mean, one of the reasons why everyone but Biden seems to be polling pretty low is mainly because of name recognition, I suppose. But so why not run for Senate? The incumbent Republican, Cory Gardner, is vulnerable. I think he's polling underwater when it comes to any Democrat. You could perhaps win that seat, or you might have a better chance of winning that seat than winning the presidency. Why not do that?
Well, I don't look at myself in terms of where can I win. I've spent my whole life in executive positions as a CEO, as a mayor, and as a governor, bringing teams of talented people together from nonprofits, from business, from government, from academia, and creating teams to achieve the big progressive goals that people didn't think could be done.
But you might be able to achieve more in the Senate.
Oh, I don't think so. I mean, if you look at the skill sets of what I'm good at, that's very different than what happens in the Senate. And what happens in the Senate is very important, but I don't think I'd be as fired up and as engaged running for Senate as I am to run for president.
All right. John Hickenlooper, former governor of Colorado, former mayor of Denver, one of nearly 24 Democrats running for president in 2020. Thanks for joining us.
You bet. Thank you, Madeline.
Coming up, will the Supreme Court revisit the census question in light of evidence that it is politically motivated or legal. Jessica Levinson is here next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Massachusetts Senator and Democratic presidential candidate Elizabeth Warren wants to change the Justice Department's current policy of not indicting a sitting president. Special Counsel Robert Mueller said that's one reason, the main reason, really, why he didn't recommend an indictment of President Trump. So is that possible, actually, to just change DOJ policy? Here to talk about it is Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School and a regular Monday Legal.
Hello.
Can she do that? She said if she's elected president, that's what she'll do.
So she said that she would embark on a two-step process. First, she would push Congress to pass legislation that's part of the federal criminal code that says you can indict a sitting president. No person is above the law. And she said that she would also appoint an assistant attorney general in the Office of Legal Counsel to basically relook at that memo and overturn the memo. Again, the memo that says you can't indict a sitting president.
But aside from the political considerations, isn't there kind of more of a constitutional question or a question that is actually goes to the heart of being able to govern the country? And that is, and it's what people have said, the reason for this memo and why it exists in the first place is that if you do indict a sitting president, you are distracting that person from running the country.
There is a legitimate reason that we have this Office of Legal Counsel understanding. And the idea is that you indict a sitting president, you put that sitting president through the criminal justice process where they have to defend themselves against criminal charges, you've torpedoed their entire presidency. And this isn't just talking about an individual who works in the federal government at a high level. The idea is you've essentially undercut the entire executive branch. You have thwarted one branch of our government by sending this indictment. I think, like so many other things in the Trump administration, we didn't previously explore how far this understanding could go and what the consequences of it might be. But I think you could absolutely make a straight-face argument on both sides.
Right. And so when Bill Clinton was impeached, before that, he could not have been indicted by his Justice Department. And perhaps Democrats were okay with that.
Exactly. So people tend to line up on now this legal question along political lines. And of course, the legal question should be divorced from that. Do you think that in the Constitution, we should understand that you can't indict the chief executive? That really should have nothing to do with whether or not you're a liberal or a conservative. But of course, I think our understanding of that is in large part dictated by, should you be able to indict the current president? Do you like the president? And that's basically what this question has shorthanded to, unfortunately.
Okay, let's move on to the 2020 census. A lot of news about that came out last week when it became known that a Republican operative had actually supplied this idea to the federal government that they should basically ask this question about citizenship on the census in order to gain political advantage when it came to redrawing districts.
Yes. So this undercuts the entire argument by the Secretary of Commerce, Secretary Wilbur Ross, who has said, because the Department of Commerce is in charge of the census, he said, I want to add this question about citizenship to the census because the Department of Justice told me it would be really useful in enforcing federal voting rights acts, that in fact, it would help protect Hispanic voters. And now we have this evidence, which frankly is consistent with a lot of other evidence we had, And in fact, it appears the idea came from a Republican who was known for his redistricting skills, a Republican operative, and that he said explicitly, this will help us draw lines which bolsters Republican power and non-Hispanic white voting power.
And is there a direct line between him and Wilbur Ross?
There, it does, if the evidence is correct, and it came from his hard drive, he's now deceased, there is a direct line. And this is, again, very consistent with evidence that we saw in lower courts who just did not believe Secretary Wilbur Ross when he said, I want to add this because of the Department of Justice. What the lower courts found is that that was highly implausible, that it strained common sense, and therefore his decision to add the question was arbitrary and capricious, which is another way of saying it would be illegal.
But the Supreme Court heard arguments on this, and they appeared to lean in favor of Wilbur Ross. Will they now reconsider, given that this evidence came out after the arguments?
I don't think so. So I think that, frankly, the Supreme Court, as we said, already heard enough to undercut Wilbur Ross. Now what we have, what we never have in court cases, which is a literal smoking gun that says, do this because it helps Republicans and non-Hispanic whites. And I don't think that the Supreme Court will consider this evidence, in part because of the questions they asked in oral arguments, and in part because we can look to, for instance, last term with the travel ban, where they said, we're ignoring statements by candidate Trump and President Trump about what the travel ban was really about. We're just looking at the face of the document. And I think that they're just going to look very narrowly and say, does the head of the Department of Commerce have discretion to put out questions on the census that he sees fit? The answer to that is probably yes. I think that they will not consider the rest of the context. And I think that that will be the end of the story. But I think it's going to be a really bitter opinion. It's going to be an awkward opinion to read, one that you just kind of want to walk out and say, like, Mom, Dad, stop fighting. I need a break from this.
Okay, finally, let's talk about the death penalty. The court heard several cases this term about it. One of them involved Christopher Lee Price. And there was really an extraordinary 3 a.m, I understand, literal dissent from Stephen Breyer on this. Christopher Lee Price was executed last week. Tell us about that.
So the issue for Mr. Price was that he claimed that he could not be executed by lethal injection because he had a condition which caused excruciating pain if he were to be subject to a lethal injection. And he said that this violates the Eighth Amendment, that it would be a cruel and unusual punishment. This is actually the second time that this issue has come before the Supreme Court. And there is a trial that's actually set for in a few days to deal with this issue of whether or not this would be cruel and unusual punishment. He asked for a stay of execution. He wanted to wait for that lower court trial to continue. A bare majority of the court said, no, let's not wait. Justice Breyer, in the middle of the night, while most of us were sleeping, said, why don't we wait till the coffee has brewed, till we can sit around the table? And what the other justices said is, because what you do on when you're on death row is that you use delaying tactics. And they said that Mr. Price had blown a number of different deadlines, that he had failed to ask for a different type of execution. And what we're really seeing here is, I think, a breakdown in the Supreme Court between what they think about the death penalty. And Justice Breyer, I believe, explicitly says at the end of his dissent, it really may be time to rethink the death penalty. It makes sense that the justices feel passionate about this. It's one of the most serious things the government can do, which is to take the life of somebody. And the Supreme Court is really the last stop in that train. They're the only ones at a certain point who can stop that execution.
All right, Jessica, thank you.
Thank you.
Jessica Levinson teaches law at Loyola Law School and is our regular Monday Legal Eagle. Coming up, Apple kills iTunes.
Our iTunes is not one app, but three. Apple Music, Apple Podcasts, and Apple TV.
And the company unveils a bunch of privacy tools just as the Department of Justice begins looking into antitrust issues with Apple. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Today, Apple announced a lot of new privacy features at its developer conference, as well as some new software and updates to the products. iTunes getting split up. But during the announcement, news broke that the Department of Justice has been given the green light to probe the company's practices. Amazon, Facebook, Google also under fire for antitrust concerns. Here to talk about what's going on in Silicon Valley is Willa Remus. He writes about tech and science for Medium. Hi there.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Great to have you back. All right, so let's talk about what the DOJ is looking at. What exactly is it going to investigate regarding Apple?
We actually don't know. So it's a little bit confusing, but what appears to have happened over the last couple of weeks is that the Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission have held a series of meetings. Now, both of these agencies have the power to review antitrust concerns. And at these meetings, they sort of seem to have divvied up the main tech companies. So what we learned is that the Department of Justice will have the jurisdiction to potentially probe Google and Apple, while the FTC will be looking more closely at Amazon and Facebook. The substance of any investigation is not yet known at this point, but this does signal that both agencies are getting serious and taking a hard look at the size of these tech companies and whether they're using that size to quash competition in various ways.
And this comes just after the Supreme Court said it was okay for consumers to sue Apple over its app policy, right?
Yeah, that's right. So Apple has one of the big places where Apple has faced some calls for antitrust scrutiny is in how it treats apps, how it treats the third-party apps that use its platform. One of the companies that has been a big complainer is Spotify, the streaming music company. Of course, Apple came out with its own music app, Apple Music. And when you subscribe to Spotify on your iPhone, Apple gets a cut of that subscription. Spotify feels like it's not a fair playing field. And there are analogous concerns from competitors for each of the other big tech platforms that we're talking about today.
Right. So that's what happens when you own the hardware and the software, right?
Yeah. And this was the thing that Elizabeth Warren, the Democratic presidential candidate, homed in on in her op-ed calling for the potential breakup of some of these big tech companies. She said you can't both, you know, be the referee and a player in the game. She's talking about the way that Apple runs its iOS app store, but also has its own apps competing with those. Google, of course, runs search and then puts some of its own services at the top of search results ahead of third-party websites. Amazon does the same thing with its online retail. When you look for, a kitchen table on Amazon, you'll see one by the Amazon brand up at the top, and then you'll see the ones from other companies. And then Facebook is a little bit different, actually. With Facebook, one of the bigger concerns has been that it's just been buying up all of the potential rivals in the social media space. It bought up Instagram and WhatsApp, and then the ones that it doesn't buy, it sort of copies their key features. So Instagram has copied most of the main features of Snapchat and has been able to subdue the potential competitive threat from Snapchat in that way.
Mm, wow, interesting. Okay, and so this all comes as this developer conference takes place where Apple basically wants it all to be good news, right? It's unveiling a whole host of new products and features. And I mean, ironically, including a bunch of apps that are going to be bundled on the phone that would compete with third-party apps, like a period tracker.
Yeah, so a big part of what Apple focused on today at its Worldwide Developer Conference, which is a conference where it really focuses on the software and the platforms on its various devices, were its own apps. You mentioned the ability to track your period and track menstrual health and reproductive health. That will be built into iOS now. There were already other apps that allowed you to do that. I don't think anybody's going to say that's a bad thing if it gets more people able to track their health in that way. But it is part of this trend of Apple using its own apps to replicate features that previously you would go through the App Store and through a different company to get.
Hmm. Okay. And it's also unveiled iOS 13. So what does that mean when you log on? What are you going to see that's different?
The changes to iOS 13 don't appear to be really transformative. Instead, what Apple has focused on is iPad OS. It has a new iPad that it's spinning off. A new operating system that it's spinning off from the iPad. This will make using the iPad feel less like just using a bigger version of an iPhone. It also won't feel exactly like using a smaller version of a Mac. It'll be its own thing. That will allow iOS to continue to focus on the iPhone experience exclusively. And it now has a different operating system for each of its major device categories.
Mm. And I noticed people are getting really excited about dark mode. What does that mean?
Yeah, so a lot of the features, it's purely cosmetic. It's a black background, and then the text will be in light color. This is a cosmetic feature that is part of a trend for Apple to just kind of give people more options for the experience of using their devices. You know, there used to be one way to use an iPhone back in the Steve Jobs era, sort of one size fits all. Apple has really been expanding into more customizability. You also see this with Watch OS, their operating system for the Apple Watch. They are all the time rolling out new watch faces, new themes, new complications, so that everybody can kind of customize it to their own liking.
Okay. All right. And tell us more about all this privacy stuff that they are unveiling. Will it actually be safer for us, privacy-wise, to be on Apple now?
Well, Apple has developed a pretty strong reputation among consumers for protecting their privacy. In the past couple of years, the company has made a clear strategic choice to focus on privacy as a selling point. It helps that their big rivals are companies like Google and Facebook, whose businesses rely on tracking information about you so that they can serve you ads targeted to your demographics, your online behavior, all that. Apple's business doesn't rely on that, of course. So they are saying, look, if you want to get control of your data, if you want a company that you can actually trust, choose Apple devices, choose Apple software. The big announcement today in the realm of privacy was a feature called Sign In with Apple. Now, for years, you've been able to sign in to some websites, online services, apps, using your Google ID or using your Facebook account, using your Twitter account. This was actually a way for Facebook and Twitter and Google to continue tracking you while you're doing other stuff, to get more insight into your behavior and keep better track of who you are and what you're up to. Apple is now rolling out its own login, but they say it's just the opposite. Their goal is to help protect your privacy. So when you sign into a new app using Sign In with Apple, it creates a temporary email address, just a one-time sort of burner email address for you to use to log into that app. That way, you're not always giving out your personal email to every company that you want to interact with online or on your phone.
Okay, very quickly, splitting up of iTunes, is that a big deal?
It's something that people have been looking forward to for a long time. I had just started at Slate about 7 years ago when Farhad Manjoo, the columnist there, said, it's time to take iTunes out back and shoot it. Well, they finally got around to that. They're breaking it up into three parts. It'll be the podcasts app, the TV app, and the music app. And you will no longer have this one big clunky app where you buy all of your different media. It's part of Apple's shift toward making more money on the media that you consume, not just when you buy the iPhone, but then they're hoping you will sign up for Apple News Plus for magazines, for Apple TV Plus for TV shows. That's really one of the directions that their business is headed.
All right. Thank you, Will.
All right. Thanks, Nella.
That's Will Arimus. He writes about tech and science for Medium. All right. Steve Giudicakis is here with a preview of Greater LA. Hi there.
Speaking of money, the
yes.
City of LA, for the educational purposes of its school children across the LAUSD, would like more of it. And so there's a ballot measure tomorrow, Measure EE, that mm-hmm. would raise taxes, right? I believe it's a parcel tax that would fund some of the things that the teachers tried to negotiate with the school system during their latest strike. So we're going to talk about that.
So if it fails, do they go back on strike?
Well, we don't know. There are a lot of questions. There is really no plan B, so we'll find out.
Oh,
and
no plan F.
Yeah. Oh, I really did that. We're also going to take you to Disneyland, too. So. Oh. Well, we won't take you there, but we're going to talk about it because they haven't. I don't know if you heard this, but there's a new exhibit
there. I think I heard a little bit about that. Thank you, Steve. That's Greater LA coming up at 1 o'clock. Coming up, the brother and sister duo of Billie Eilish and Finneas O'Connell. Finneas here to talk about how his sister became a huge pop star and how he is branching out on his own. That's next on Press Play. The This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Monday, so that means it's the day we talk about music here on Press Play. There's one musician in particular who has been rising to the top of the charts recently. Her name, Billie Eilish.
So you're a tough guy, like you really rough guy. Just can't get enough guy, just always so puff guy. I'm that bad type, make your mama sad type. Make your girlfriend mad type, might seduce your dad type. I'm the bad guy.
Duh. That's Bad Guy from her debut album, When We All Fall Asleep, Where Do We Go? It dropped at the end of March. Her songs have been streamed more than a billion times, but she didn't do it all by herself. That beat you're hearing, it's produced by her brother, who also co-writes her songs, and he is his own musician. His name is Phineas O'Connell. He joins me now in the studio. Hi.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. All right, so the breakthrough song for Billie Eilish was called Ocean Eyes.
True.
Right?
Yeah.
Tell us about how that was put together.
That song was recorded by the two of us at the end of 2015. We started recording it in October. At the time, I was in a band, a sort of high school age. I was 18, and we started to play that song at shows. And it was, I just kind of knew immediately that it wasn't how the song should be played. It felt like in a band's kind of orchestration with two guitars and drums and bass. It was like a Soundgarden song, which is cool. But I had just in my head when I wrote the song heard it differently. And that night, went home and was sort of pondering that to myself, and went into my sister's room and said, like, you know that song Ocean Eyes that I wrote? And she was like, yeah, our house is so small, of course I know that song, you've been playing it for 5 days. And I was like, yeah, do you like it? And she was like, I love it, which was really nice of her. And she's also very honest, so if she hadn't loved it,
she would have told you.
She'd been like, I don't love it.
Yeah,
but she loved it, which was wonderful. And I said, are you interested in singing it? I think your voice would sound much better on it than mine. And she said, yeah.
I've been watching you for some time, can't stop staring at those ocean eyes, burning cities and napalm skies, 15 flares inside those ocean eyes, your ocean eyes on fire.
Billie at the time was dancing something like 17 hours a week. She was taking a lot of dance classes and in a dance company, and sort of at the time, like, that was her primary focus, was dance. And one of her choreographers had taught me dance classes when I was a younger teen, and knew that we both made music, and had said to her, you know, if you want to record something, I'll choreograph a piece to it. And so we were stoked, we were pumped on the opportunity, and we had taken classes long enough to sort of know what would work in a dance setting, like the sort of body tempo, if you will, of like how fast a song should be, the way that like the lyrics should be spaced out in the recording and the delivery and how much percussion there should be and how little percussion there should be. And so we sort of set about recording it with this very kind of clear set of goals in mind of what we'd have to achieve, which is really helpful.
A lot of the time, this was basically just for your dance teacher.
100% just for the dance teacher. Like, there was no other sort of reason at all. And we put it out on her SoundCloud, which had probably like maybe 100 followers, which
and
were
this
like
is when she was 13.
Yeah, friends and friends of friends following. And then sent it to the dance teacher with a download link, just like a download button on, and said, like, here, check it out. We made a song. And we went to bed, and like overnight it got not so many plays, like maybe 1,000 plays, but we weren't like tremendously popular kid. Like 1,000 was a lot, you know, we were pretty stoked on 1,000, and then kind of kept going up, and a manager who I'd been bothering about managing my band texted me and was like, what is the story with this song with your sister? And, you know, I love it. Like, maybe don't let people download it for free. Like, that was sort of the first hint of commerce in art. In our lives.
It's just so wild how it happens so fast.
I know. And I feel like a couple months earlier, I'd seen a Halsey interview, and she was like, I made this song called Ghost, and we put it out online, and I went to bed, and I woke up, and it was like on the charts. And I remember being like, that's BS. Like, no way. like, that doesn't happen. And then it happened. It happened to us. I was like, oh, I guess it can just happen. We didn't chart right away, but, you know, but it does, you, stuff does happen quickly. Yeah.
But a lot of your songs are, shall we say, soulful, not upbeat.
Right.
Sad.
Sad, yeah.
There's one called Bury a Friend.
Yeah. That one's kind of upbeat, though.
Is it?
That's a pretty upbeat one.
Yeah.
What do you want from me? Why don't you run from me? What are you wondering? What do you know? Why aren't you scared of me? Why do you care for me? When we all fall asleep, where do we go?
Come here.
Say it, spit it out. What is it exactly? Your pain is the amount cleaning you out. Am I satisfactory? Today I'm thinking about the things that are deadly. The way I'm drinking you down, like I wanna drown, like I wanna end me. Step on the glass, staple your tongue. Bury a friend, try to wake up. Cannibal class, killing the sun. Bury a friend, I wanna end me.
Okay, it may sound upbeat.
Yeah, well, it's upbeat in its literal in its literal beat. It's not. It's definitely not a positive song. Yeah.
Wait, what? You are what? 21?
Yes. Yeah.
Where does all this sadness?
Have you like read the news lately?
Yeah.
It's a super dark time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Being 21 and 17 in America right now is like, you know, I think you're. You're not paying close attention if you think everything's super positive right now. So I think it's just mainly a reflection of like the world that we're growing up in.
You feel stressed.
Everybody feels
depressed,
stressed.
Anxious.
Yeah, 100%. And I think even like as a 21-year-old, I don't feel super qualified to talk about like a 13-year-old's reality because I didn't have Instagram at 13. I had Facebook, but Facebook was kind of a different entity. And, you know, at 14, I got an Instagram, but there was no pressure. Like, you know, my friends and I all had 100 followers and it was people we knew, you know. And I feel like now kids are like stressing out about like how popular they are online. Mm-hmm. It's all really fascinating. And I do think it's really sad that people feel isolated, even though they're sort of in a constant. It's like we've never had more opportunity to communicate in history, and we've never been worse at communication because it's really like the lack of emotional communication. It's like really surface level. Here is what I'm doing today. It's not so much like here is how I am feeling today.
But do you feel comfortable expressing that in music?
I do. So that's where I have that outlet.
And do you think that there's a difference between how you view it mm-hmm. and how your sister, who's what, 4 years younger?
Yes.
Than you?
Uh-huh.
Billie Eilish, how she views it?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, she was so young when she broke that there's not all that much younger than when we started making music professionally.
13, yeah.
Yeah. You're in true. Such a kind of quick transitional period before that where
but
every 6 months
has it messed
changed.
With her at all?
Yeah, it messed with everybody. Yeah. I think, you know, there are so few people dealing with high levels of fame and scrutiny that there is not a lot of ability to see other people and relate yourself to them. You feel ostracized by dint of your unique place in mm-hmm. I guess, for lack of a more interesting word, society. And so I think that's often why you see people with some level of public persona gravitate toward other people with some level of public persona. It's just the same as like if you have a job, someone else with the same job you relate to. I think it's like if somebody's taking pictures of you right when you get off a plane and there's someone else that has that, you go like, hey, we both know how weird this is, you know. And there's elements of like feeling excited about it, I'm sure, you know, speaking on behalf of Billie. And then there's a lot of elements of it just feeling really invasive, I'm sure.
Well, and you two grew up so close and you were homeschooled.
Uh-huh, yeah.
So it was like just the two of you kind of in the house making music.
Yeah, I mean, we had a lot of friends. I think the misnomer about homeschooling in a lot of ways is that it's this super isolating thing. And I'm sure there are cases where it is, but in my experience, almost all people's friends are through extracurriculars, mm-hmm. pretty much. You know, I played soccer growing up and then I played basketball and I sang in a choir. And Those were all my close friends. But if you talk to all them, and they also all went to school, all their close friends were the kids they played soccer with and the kids they were in the choir. You know what I mean? It's like, because it's the things that you elect to do. It's the electives that you find kind of commonality with people.
So you know, don't feel like you missed out on anything?
No, and probably a thing I'm guilty of, and it's probably by and large arrogance, was I always felt like a lot of the high school stuff was very trivial to me. I was the kid that was like, really? Like, for taking a limo to prom? Like, it just all felt like so contrived and crazy to me. I was like, how is this not played out? How are we still doing this? It always felt so ridiculous.
Didn't you want to go to prom?
I went to prom, and I was just like, this sucks.
Oh,
this is terrible.
You know what? I think a lot of high school students say the same thing.
Yeah, and I also never much liked, dancing. So I always thought, like, if I could be performing, I bet I'd be pretty comfortable up there instead of being on this dance floor.
When did you start performing?
My band started playing shows when I was like 14, and we got pretty good when I was like 17. And we worked really hard at it.
You played out in LA?
Yeah, we played like wherever we could. There's a lot of like battles of the bands for high school age kids.
Uh-huh.
There was one at like the House of Blues and one at the Club Nokia, which is now the Novo.
Would you go to the Smell?
Oh, you know what? My band was never, my clothes were always too clean to go to the Smell. I wasn't grungy enough for the Smell. Kids were like, yeah, this is, get out
of
here.
I love how you like kids and you're 21.
Yeah, well, this is the real plight of, this is like the stuff where I like, don't watch interviews of mine back because I'm like, wow, what a pretentious person. but yeah, I was kind of like that at 15 too. But no, it was, we played shows at a place called Amplify a lot, a place called Rusty's on the Santa Monica Pier.
Mm-hmm.
That was a mainstay of
ours.
There's
always a Rusty on a pier.
There's always a Rusty's. It was called Rusty's Surf Ranch. What's a surf ranch? That's
it's so like surf and turf.
Yeah, you know? That's true. Yeah, that's true. That's great. You know, I saw a friend of mine play last night named Adam Melcher, and he said a thing that I was like, yes, I was so happy that he said it. He goes, I spent so many years playing to the back of people's heads in restaurants.
And, that is a really good image.
And he was like just looking at everybody's weird hairline and like, you know, bad perms. And he goes, it's just really nice to see the front of all of your faces. And I was like, that is how, if you've played shows to people who actively don't want you to be playing shows for them, like like you're just like so excited when people shut up and listen to you. It's the best feeling.
All right, let's play another song.
Okay.
This is a song called I Lost a Friend.
Yes.
And this is under you.
This is my own name, yeah.
Phineas.
All right, but I'm not tonight. I'm on the mend, but I lost a friend. I lost my mind, and nobody believes me. Say I know that he don't need me, 'cause he made a little too much money to be 20 and sad. And I'll be fine without him, but all I do is write about him. How the hell did I lose a friend I never had?
Yeah, I went through a thing that I think almost everybody's been through at least once. Last summer, where we'd been on tour for a couple months, and I came back and I had this best friend who I'd been best friends with since I was like 14, and I was like, I'm back, let's hang out, let's, you know, grab some coffee. And he was like, no. But you know, I think we just had grown apart, and you know, we started out in a very similar place at 14, and we ended up in kind of different places at 21. And then, yeah,
there's... Do you think it has to do with the fact that you
got incredibly successful?
And
yeah,
successful.
Totally.
And your friend did not.
Probably.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Because you grew up in, you know, not wealthy conditions, right? You
no.
grew up in a 2-bedroom house in Highland Park.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah, our parents were very sweet. They let me have one of the bedrooms, and they let Billy have the other bedroom, and they slept in the living room. Yeah, it's a very nice one.
On the couch?
Mm-hmm. Futon.
Wow.
Uncomfortable. It's great.
Great parents. Shout out to your parents.
They're the best. Yeah, they're awesome. We never had any money, and we were really happy. It's great. I think that's like super, that was a super important part of growing up, is like if you grow up poor and happy, then.
And there are actors set. And musicians. And
yeah, through most of our childhood, they were teachers, and our dad's a carpenter, so they were just working jobs to, you know, keep food on the table. But yeah, they met acting and performing in New York.
And then you were playing music in the house growing up.
There was a lot of music in the house. There was a lot of guitars and like old sort of like childhood guitars of theirs, and you know, my granddad's piano, stuff like that.
That's great.
Which was great. But there was a lot of musical instruments in the house.
So you're going on tour.
Yes.
Together.
Yeah. Yeah. I play in her band. It's really fun.
And you're opening for her?
I've been opening for her since like October, and I've fired myself from opening for her for a while.
So you're doing your own thing.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Separate from her.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Which is fun. And then I stand way behind her and just smile at my little sister, which is really fun.
Well, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks so much for having me. It's really, really cool to be here. I've listened to this segment for years.
Oh, well, thank you. That's Finneas O'Connell, musician, producer, songwriter. He and his sister, Billie Eilish, are on their When We All Fall Asleep tour now. They'll be here in LA at the Greek July 11th. Okay, that'll do it for us today. Don't forget, you can subscribe to our podcast. It's free and it's on iTunes. So just do that. Thank you very much. I will see you tomorrow.